professor here at Perimeter and at IQC. I work in experiments. I'm the token experimentalist for this program. And what we'll do over the next 3 weeks is teach you a little bit about how to look at experimental systems. So the idea is to see that as a theorist, you can understand experimental systems in great detail. And my hope is that when you do theory in the future, you'll make your theory very, very relevant to experiments. And breaking all the rules by not putting this on, though you can hear me fine, I'm sure, that, but we'll be nice to those that want to listen to a tape. What I'm going to do is talk to you about three different experimental pieces. And we're going to start by talking about neutron interferometry. The reason for that is it's a beautiful, clean quantum system, and we can show you every little detail. There's nothing that we have to leave out about that. So we can build a language of talking about quantum devices, and we can do that quickly. And you'll see how it all comes together. And then we're going to turn to what's a very popular quantum system today, the nitrogen vacancy defect in diamond. And this is a room temperature quantum system where you can look at one defect in the system. It's one carbon atom that's been replaced by a nitrogen, and you'll have a stable free electron there. Turns out to be a spin one electron. I'll explain that in a week. And it's a beautiful coherent system, and it has the advantage that you can see it at room temperature. You can see it very compactly. You can see it with very high visibility, very high sensitivity. And you can think to build small sensors. So basically, we can imagine that we can build quantum devices that you can take out to the lab and use for things. And so we'll tell you about this. Now, here, this already starts to get somewhat complicated. And so we'll use the tools we developed there. We'll give you an almost complete description. I won't tell you anything that's wrong, but you know. The diamond lattice, there's a lot of energy levels. So we'll focus on a subset of those that we have control over and show you that. And then I want you to close the last week I'll teach you about superconducting circuits. And the idea here is that you can build your own quantum system. The nice thing about the superconducting piece is that you can design a quantum system. You can specify exactly what the Hamiltonian you want is, and then you can build the system so that you can have your own Hamiltonian. So you get to be God. And this, of course, both of these systems are very much in the news. This is coming back. But you might have heard that IBM claimed a week ago that in 15 years they'll have a quantum computer. Don't buy IBM stock based upon that just yet. But there's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of things you can do building your own quantum circuits. So we'll talk about that as well. Now, what I want to do in the class is get you to the point that not only you can understand these things, but that that you can think about designing circuits yourself. So in the first one, what we're going to ask you to do is to design an experiment to measure the spin dependence of the gravitational constant. It's been suggested that there is such a thing. It's never been observed. But using neutron interferometry, you could actually consider measuring such a thing. So we'll look at that. It's a piece of forefront of standard model physics. In V-cent defects in diamond, there's one of the nice things about using an V defect is because of the coherence in that this is like having an electron. It's been described as nature's ion traps. It's like having an atomic defect in a solid-state system. Very, very clean. So we can build sensors out of this, and so we'll ask you to design such a thing. And then here, we can kick it around. I was thinking of asking you to design an error detecting code, but not from the code point of view, right? You've all taken Daniel's course in quantum information? Okay, so you've heard about that. But from the Hamiltonian point of view, that you can build up the process right from the ground level and say, okay, I want the system to evolve as though it was an error detecting code. And so we'll be able to do that. And look, it's a small enough class. If there are other things you want to hear, you know, just tell me. We'll be able to do that. Okay. Now, the way we're going to do this is I'll use the boards. I'll lecture. I really do like questions, so don't be shy about that. But I'll give you a Mathematica notebook for each of the lectures that we have. And so the Mathematica notebook has more material in it than, of course, what I can cover in an hour. And so you'll have that. And embedded in the notebook are some problems, some very, you know, small problems in a few tutorial problems that you have to work on a little bit longer, okay? So we'll have those. I also give you a CDF version. So CDF is a shareable format that allows you to compile a Mathematica notebook. And so with the CDF, you can download the CDF reader for free from Wolfram for any operating system. And then you can compile a Mathematica. You can't modify it, but you can compile it. And so you'll be able to do that as well. Okay, so let's start with neutron interferometry. So neutron interferometry is basically a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And so that you've probably heard of before, but it's based upon neutrons. So we have a neutron beam coming in. And the way we create the interferometer is to use Bragg scattering off of a single crystal of silicon. So we have a perfect blade of silicon with the planes going this way. And we have diffraction in the Lowy geometry. So it's Bragg scattering, but it's in the Lowy geometry. And so it's forward scattered. That's all it means. Okay. And of course, in order to have Bragg scattering, we need to have the de Broglie wavelength of the neutron match the periodicity of the crystal. And we can do that with relatively slow neutrons. So the neutrons that we're looking at have a wavelength of about 2.7 angstroms. And they'll be traveling with a velocity of about 2,000 meters a second. So that's slow. And if you looked at the temperature corresponding to this momentum, they're relatively cold. That the average temperature for these is about 20 degrees Kelvin. Now, if you want neutrons, you need a reactor. It's not absolutely true, but it's the easiest place to find neutrons. So we have a reactor, and of course, neutrons are born hot. So if I look at the neutrons coming out of the reactor, there are no 20 Kelvin. Well, there aren't many 20 Kelvin neutrons coming out of a reactor. So out of the reactor, what we have is a cold source. We have a pool of material with lots of hydrogen in it that is very, very cold, about 8 degrees Kelvin. And we scatter the neutrons in that so they thermalize, and then they come out. All right. So this is the first piece. Now, of course, if I have a Mach Zehnder interferometer, I need to get the neutrons back together, right? And so we have the neutrons coming in, they scatter, they're coherently split so that what we have is a superposition of neutrons leaving this crystal in two directions. And so I'd like to have another blade here. And this second blade is going to act just like the first one. So there'll be another Bragg event happening here. And the neutrons are free to go now in any of these four paths. The reason we use a blade, now if you built a Mach Zehnder interferometer, normally you would think that I should put a mirror here. But there are no mirrors. There are no good mirrors for neutrons. And so instead of having a mirror, we use another blade. And of course, I need to recombine the beams. And so I need a third blade here. So I have another Bragg event. And you might say, well, you don't really need to combine the beams, that the neutrons come together anyways. But of course, the paths don't overlap, right? Let me say that a different way. The paths don't interact with each other. In order to see interference, we need an interaction there. So I need a third blade. All right, so this is the setup for an interferometer. And if you try to do this with three separate blades, as I've shown you, you'll never see interference. Because each of these needs to be aligned perfectly with the incoming neutron beam. They need to be aligned to within a thousandth of a degree. And so the way we build this is like this. We take one really big crystal of silicon. By big, I mean 20 centimeters, piece of crystal like this. And we machine from it these three blades. And so if I'm looking on the side, it looks like this. And of course, it looks like that. And since I've machined it out of one solid crystal, then what happens is that if I align the first blade, then the second and third blade are automatically aligned. So I only have one alignment step for the whole process. Okay, so this is so-called perfect single crystal. I'm not sure why we need the word single in there, given it's perfect, but that's the name of it. Okay, so now then, we have two paths. They come together, and they can exit the interferometer. And we'll keep in mind that this distance is about 20 centimeters. Can be less, but that's about the biggest interferometer we're looking at. So we're creating a path-based interferometer. So we're looking at interference over a path degree of freedom. We have a reactor over here generating many, 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 many neutrons, but it won't generate many neutrons of the type of the energy that we want. And so we end up with about one neutron a second of the right energy. So if I have one neutron a second, they're traveling 2 kilometers per second. This distance is of order 10 centimeters or 20 centimeters. The time that the neutron is in the interferometer is only 100 microseconds. So there's never 2 neutrons in the interferometer at the same time. So what we're looking at is having a quantum behavior of one neutron in the interferometer at the time, and we're looking at the interference as the two paths recombine. Okay? Good. Now, I'm going to skip all that. This I don't want to skip. We put a detector here. We want to be able to count the neutrons. So we put 2 different detectors. And the detectors that we use are helium-3 detectors. And if I take helium-3 and I add a neutron to it, then I get out tritium plus hydrogen. And we get out 700 kV. You have some energy. The cross-section for this is huge. It's 5,000 barns. So by putting a small pool of helium here and detecting the charges that are created by the capture of a neutron by helium-3, we're able to detect every neutron that goes through. So our efficiency of detection is very, very high. And of course, if I have this capture process of helium-3, helium-3, of course, has spin. Neutron has spin. This is a spin-dependent process. We'll only have a capture event if the helium-3 and the neutron have spin of opposite sign. So for most of what we do, we don't worry about that. We think that the helium could have any polarization here, and so we can detect a neutron regardless of its neutron polarization. But later on, if we want to look at spin-dependent neutron physics, then I can polarize the helium-3 and only detect those neutrons that have a particular spin. All right. Good. Now we need to decide on a coordinate system if we're going to describe the physics here. So we'll look at the momentum in those directions, kx and ky. And I want to label the path degrees of freedom. So we're going to label the path degrees of freedom based upon the sign of the kx momentum. So we'll have now a qubit, right? We have 2 paths. So we can write the qubit in this Hilbert space. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to define the zero state as kx is greater than 0, and the 1 state as kx is less than 0. Okay, and so you can see that in this particular version, we're saying that the neutron enters. In fact, for everything I do today, the dynamics are going to be unitary. So we'll just take it as a pure state. Okay, so we have that the incoming wave function is in the zero state. Okay? And we see that the action of the first blade is to coherently rotate it into the plus and minus states. And if we have our lattice vectors here, and we imagine a neutron coming in and going and being scattered and going out, then of course the Bragg condition tells us that the magnitude of that momentum vector doesn't change, but its phase can change. Now, of course, the transmitted wave is not going to change, whether it's transmitted in that direction or if it's transmitted in this direction. Not so good at that figure. So the process that we'll look at has an operator that describes the rotation of the neutrons from being the zero state to being equally probable to being in either the zero or the one state. Okay? And in Mach-Zehnder interferometry, you almost always see this as being described by a Hadamard gate, which you must have seen in Daniel's class. And of course, this is a rotation about the XZ direction, right? So if I wrote it as a matrix exponential, it would be a rotation about the XZ direction by pi. Here, what we have is a rotation about the Y direction. So U is equal to e to the I sigma y. Remember that if we're looking at matrix exponentials of polys, there's always a factor of 2. And so this is a pi over 2 rotation about the y-axis. Easy to convince yourself of if you don't. So what does this phase come from? This phase arises because when I have the incoming beam and it's in this direction, then the piece that's transmitted is out of phase with the transmitted beam in that direction. Okay, so it's just the Bragg condition for that. Okay? All right, so here we have U of the blade is equal to 1 over the square root of 2, 1, 1 minus 1, 1. Yeah. So it depends on the width of the crystal. So as we change the angle here, what we would in fact do is we would change the wavelength of the neutrons we select. And although we try really hard to have just that energy neutrons, and there's 3 monochromators in a row, in fact, there's quite a spread. And so what happens is we have a distribution of energies in the incoming beam. So let's just take that as lambda and the probability of some lambda. And only a small sliver of this is going to end up in our detectors. And the rest of it is just going to come out through that port. It's as though it never sees the crystal. And so exactly as you said, that as I change the width of that blade, then we want to change that angle. And so what we end up with is cosine of theta over 2, sine theta over 2 minus. So in general, we can have an interference which is not a 50-50. As we've seen it here. Great. Okay. Now, at the center blade, we said, hey, exactly the same thing happens, right? But I only care about those neutrons that come back into the third blade. And so I could take this operator for the first blade. And I could use it for this blade, but I'd have a problem, right? Because I've added another path. And so I would have had to add another qubit to my model. I'd have to expand the Hilbert space to have dimension 4 instead of 2. And what we're going to do is something that's done in all optics experiments and in most interferometry experiments. We're going to invoke fair sampling. And what we say is that those neutrons that leave the interferometer carry away no interesting information. So here, we end up putting a piece of cadmium. And here I'll put a piece of cadmium. Cadmium absorbs all neutrons. Okay, so no neutrons that hit cadmium are going to go anywhere else. You're going to stop right there. And so by putting this piece of cadmium and describing the action of this whole thing, it looks like, in fact, we have a mirror. And we need to worry, and I'll ask you to look at it as a part of your tutorial problem, of saying, hey, is fair sampling justified? Now, of course, we test that experimentally. And you need to do it. But you can see what happens. That here, we're going to say that we have a unitary, which is a mirror. That looks like this. We write it with this extra factor of I. You know, you would think that if I looked at this blade, I should just write it as plus and minus 1. There's an extra phase because of the width of the blade. So we get a factor of I here. But now we have this mirror here that all it does is it takes the path 0, maps it into the path 1, and it picks up a phase. And it takes a map, the path 1, and maps it into the path 0, and it picks up a phase. And we've written it so as though it's unitary, even though we lose half of the neutrons. Right? And so that is the essence of fair sampling. It says, we'll treat this, we'll really rescale the system and treat it unitarily. Although we know that in a larger space, it's not. Yeah? Okay. All right, so now given this piece, the third blade acts exactly like the first blade. I put it up there, then immediately I want to write something on it. I actually. Let me do it as I do it in the notes so that I don't confuse you later. If I'm going to see interference here, I need to change something about these paths, right? In a normal in a Mach Zender interferometer, what we would normally do is we change one of the path lengths. In order to change the path length, we're going to put inside the beam a thin sliver of silica. And the reason we use silica is it's not a crystal, so there'll be no Bragg scattering. And what will happen is that just like having an index of refraction, the neutrons are slowed down as they move from going in air, in this case, into the silica. So they'll move a little bit slower. And you can see that depending upon the orientation of this blade, the path length is slightly different in the two beams, right? Because the paths are at an angle to each other. So by rotating this, I can change the path length. So we can introduce a phase shift between the two. And the reason we put it in both of those paths is that the phase shift for silica is pi for 40 microns. And so even though we use a thin piece of silica, we don't use one that's 40 microns thin. Otherwise, what we would see is some mechanical vibrations that would be a drag. So then now, of course, it's just a difference. So we could write... I'll get this right someday. We could write this phase as being e to the I phase in the zero path, e to the I phase in the one path, right? And these would be related to each other by that rotation. But of course, I can take out the global phase, right? And so I'll take out the phase in the zero path, and we'll write it as e to the I phi 1, e to the I phi 0 minus phi 1, 0, 0, 1. And what we expect, of course, is that this global phase will have no influence on the resultant signal, right? So we're happy with that. So now then, we have a complete description of the system. So we can say that we have psi in, which is acted on by the first blade, and then is acted on by the phase, and then sees the mirror, and then has the third blade. And of course, the unitary for the third blade really is identical to the first blade, right? There we're mapping the up and down paths, the kx plus and minus paths into kx plus and minus, right? So these two are the same. Okay, and then this will be the output of this device. And we can write all this out. And end up, and that's bad. I didn't even write it all out. You can see it. In the notebooks, I'll show you in just a second. We'll have that all written out. But here, if I multiply it all out, we end up with this nice, simple result. And of course, look, let's do it quickly. We start off with phi n. That is 1, 0. Then we have the first blade. And so now we have a state, which is 1 over the square root of 2 of 1, 1. And of course, we got this by multiplying 1 over the square root of 2 times that. We multiply it by the phase shift. And we said that we're only going to phase shift the upper beam. We're going to drop the global face. And then we have the mirror. And there's a 90-degree phase shift associated with the mirror. So we stick it in there. And then we have the last blade. And so now then we have 1 over the square root of 2 times 1, 1, minus 1, 1, I over the square root of 2 for the state, 1 e to the plus I delta phi. And so now we get I over the square root of I over 2. And 1 plus e to the I delta phi minus 1 plus e to the I delta phi, like so. And simply expand in terms of sines and cosines. And life is good. We end up having here the probability. Should be a little bit more careful. Oh, I'll tell you. The reason I screw up like this is I wrote my notebook in terms of the density matrix. And then I say, it's all pure. We'll just put it in as pure state. But okay, we have this state at the end. And now we ask, hey, what's the probability that I'm going to see an output at the top detector or the bottom detector? And now we can take a projector along those and look at psi. So you say, oh yes, if I have the O detector, which is the plus KX detector, the O operator is that projector. Or if I have the H detector, which is minus KX, the projector is such. Right? And so we end up having a probability of 1 plus cosine phi divided by 2, and a probability of 1 minus cosine phi divided by 2. So we end up with these two contrast curves that ideally go from 1 to 0 as a function of phi going from 0 to 2 pi. And we can see what happens. As you change the phase of that phase flag, the two path degrees of freedom interfere with each other. And the neutrons come out one path or the other path. And by choosing the angle of phi, I can arrange for them to all go out one path, to be equally probable to come out both, to all go out the other path, or anything over that full spectrum. Yeah? Okay. So now we have a really simple physical system that has all of the features we'll need to describe quantum mechanics. And this, what we're going to do over the next lecture, next two lectures, is build in all of the additional physics. This is the ideal case of a neutron interferometer. What we'll see is that, of course, experimentally, we don't realize this ideal. Experimentally, the curves, well, they'll look sort of like it. I'll show you in the notebook, but they'll be reduced from the amplitude. They'll be shifted up from zero. Okay, those two different pieces of physics. But before I go there, let's make sure that we all are on the same page. So now I'm going to draw the neutron interferometer just with three lines instead of drawing blades. We have the neutrons coming in. They go like so. We're going to completely forget that there's these other paths because we've invoked fair sampling, that they don't exist anymore. And we've said that there's just a phase in this path, so we'll only have that phase. Okay, so now we have our neutron interferometer. And everything's ideal. There's a 50-50 probability of being here. Okay, and we'll have our two neutrons coming out. And this is the O and H beams. Unfortunately, for bad historic reasons. But, you know, that's the challenge of physics. You're stuck with the language that was developed over the last 150 years. Okay, so here's the challenge. I rotate this phase until all of the neutrons are in this path. Yeah, I can do that. We see it right here. You can rotate the phase until all the neutrons are in one path. That's one. What happens now when I put a piece of cadmium here? Cadmium, of course, absorbs all the neutrons, right? So what do I see at my two detectors having put that piece of cadmium there? Say this again. I didn't hear you. Okay, so we'll see equal probability at each detector. Now I worry about this word same. So I had some intensity, I0, at the O detector. What's the intensity I'll see after I put the piece of cadmium there? Perfect. That's exactly right. So by putting the piece of cadmium here, the only path that impinges on this is the upper path. Okay. And so now I'll get an intensity of I naught over 2 at each of those. And I want you to explore this in more detail in your tutorial. I want you to explain to me why such an experiment is incompatible with thinking about the neutrons in a classical sense. So if the neutron took this path or that path, right? If I could assign a path to a neutron, then I would build into this a conflict by having those two outcomes. Tell me why that is, okay? I also want you to look at what would happen to that interpretation, but only after you have the interpretation. If you include the possibility that the neutrons that leave the interferometer carry information away, because that actually introduces a loophole into your arguments about what can happen. And so consider those pieces as well. Now, in thinking about quantum mechanics, I mean, a lecture that I'm sure you've heard over and over and over again, we need to be careful in how we describe things. And as an experimentalist, the thing that I care about is that as I describe physics, I do so honestly, and I don't bias my understanding of the system in the language. And so, of course, what's happened here is we've taken a neutron beam, and we've created a coherent superposition of the neutron taking two paths. Okay. And you know, it's tempting to think about, well, if I see a neutron, can I assign a path and all this garbage? And from my point of view, and a subset of physics, we want to know what the experiment is. If we ask a question, you have to tell us what the experiment is. And of course, if I took one of these detectors and I put it here, then I would see half the neutrons. And if I put a detector here, I would see half the neutrons. Okay. But, of course, if I put a detector here, then the neutrons aren't free to follow through, right? We'll talk a little bit later about an experiment where instead of putting a helium-3 detector, you put a superconducting quantum interference device there so that we can look at the magnetic field of the neutrons moving through and ask, how much do we change? How much do we learn? How much do we modify the neutrons by learning that? And what happens to the contrast at the end? Okay, so we'll see that too. I'd use the word contrast. Contrast is the depth of those curves. So if I look at those curves and they go from 1 to 0, that has contrast 1. If it goes from 0.75 to 0.25, that has contrast 1/2. All right. Okay, so let's look at this notebook and see. No, I just need to wait. Okay, so this is the notebook. I start off telling you a little bit more about silicon a little bit more about Bragg scattering, things that, I'm sure you've Bragg scattering that you've seen, give you a nicer picture of the neutron interferometer. So this is what these actually look like when we have them in our hands. They're about so big, machined very carefully. There's a few different geometries. I'll explain why a little bit later. And incredibly fragile, and each one takes well, it takes about a year to machine properly, because very small surface imperfections destroy the physics. Hey, what's happened? Okay, so we talk about the helium-3 detectors, the cross sections, properties of the neutrons, give you an idea of what the reactor with its cold source. So this is the reactor. And here, this little ball there, that is the cold source that we have. So that's where we have liquid. That's not lithium or anything. That's liquid hydrogen. We look at the distribution of energies. Of course, it's thermalized, so it's a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Those things you must know already. Forget all that. I'll describe that some other time. Our interferometer, we go ahead and calculate these things explicitly for you. And so we end up at the end with the result that we got here that says that, yes, we have a contrast curve. And plotting those in here, this is the best contrast curve we get experimentally. Yeah. Typical data, meaning that after years and years of study, this is the best one. And you can see that the counts are pretty low. This axis is the phase, but it's written down in terms of the difference in the width over that silica piece, right? So we had the silica blade that we rotated, and it had a difference in path length in the two beams. And so this is a difference in path length of that particular silicon beam. And we see that we have a nice sinusoidal dependence, just as it should be, but it doesn't quite reach zero as it should, and it certainly doesn't reach anywhere near one as it should. Right, and so we want to understand what's going on with these system and explain the physics correctly and perfectly. Dima is the one who took the data. And the rest of this I'll let you just look over, and there's the tutorial problem with a little bit of it worked out. Okay, so you have those things. We'll start. Now, I'm assuming that most of what we did today is somewhat familiar to you, that you've seen Mach-Zehnder interferometers before. Is that true? It's true for some of you. And probably, though, looking at the errors in a physical system is not. And you might think, well, as a theorist, why do I care about the errors? But a lot of the theory today in quantum information science deals with, can we control quantum systems robustly, and can we do it with precision? And in the data we saw, clearly we can do it with some precision. These things really do look like sinusoids, but we can't do it very robustly here. And that piece of it, one needs to understand the physics before you can attack that problem. And I'll tell you just as a preamble that we were able to use a quantum error correcting code to improve this. And so you can take the ideas that you've learned from Daniel You can apply them very generically for physical systems. So we'll do that. Okay, so next class, we'll look at general open system dynamics over SU2, and then we'll apply those ideas to the neutron interferometer. And I had to tell you that that's on Friday of this week. Unfortunately, I'm going to be in Boston, so there won't be a lecture on Friday. We'll figure out where we can make it up. Thanks.